What is the theme of the book of Revelation? What? Okay, victory. That's not a bad answer. Victory. What verse are we using? 17:14. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them because He is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. It's a book about war and conflict, and then about the victory of the Lamb and the victory of those who follow the Lamb. You're talking to someone, a co-worker, a friend, a family member, just someone out in the community about the book of Revelation. And they say, the book of Revelation is about things that, mainly about things that haven't happened yet. How can you show, regardless of what you may feel competent about in explaining all the things in the book, how can you show that there's something wrong with that right on the very surface? Where could you turn in the book of Revelation to show there's something wrong with that right on the very surface?
1:1.
Right, very good. 1:1 and 3 say these are the things which must soon take place. Verse 3, the time is near. So this person says, that's right, that was talking about chapters 1 through 3. Now what?
They're going to go to chapter 4.
What will you do?
22:20.
That's right. Go to chapter 22. Good answer. Look at 22. Look at verse 6. The things which must soon take place. Verse 7. I'm coming quickly. Verse 10, the time is near. Verse 12, I'm coming quickly. Verse 20, I'm coming quickly. So the same thing you have in the first three chapters, you have in throughout the book, and here you have it in the last chapter. So to make the bulk of the book, 4 through 22, to talk about things that hasn't happened, seems to go against this very clear thing that said in the very beginning of the book and at the very end of the book. Okay, so you're talking to someone about the book of Revelation. And if they've been taught in their church premillennialism, they're going to say that the first three chapters are talking about the church age. If they picked up on what maybe they're pastor or teacher was saying, the church age. I know this may not be a real good question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How would you respond? Let me back up on that question. They've said that the first three chapters are the church age. Have they proven it by saying it? So what could you respond?
Show me.
So again, it's not likely most people you talk to is going to be very adept at turning to places, but let's suppose they do remember that the chapters 2 and 3 are written to seven churches. And so they say, well, don't you know that chapters 2 and 3 contain letters or a letter to seven churches, a letter to each church included in that. Is that true? So doesn't that prove that chapters 1 through 3 is talking about the church age? Let's suppose, back, some of you went to college, or your children went to college. And so the way the people are reasoning is because there's letters to the churches, therefore, it's talking about the church age. There's a missing premise in there. That missing premise is that if these letters are to churches and that encompasses the whole time that there may be churches in existence, which would be from the time this was written until the end of time. Or until the rapture, they think the rapture, the church would be taken up from the earth. So you were in college, or you have children in college. And either when you were in college, you received the letter, or you wrote to your children in college a letter. So that was a letter to a child in college. Now, does that prove that what you talked about in that letter covers the time from the time you were in college as long as colleges exist? Does it? Somebody said, that's the college age. And so what's in that letter has to do with the time from the time that you wrote it and as long as there are colleges on the earth. You say, that doesn't follow. That's not logical. Correct? Same thing with these letters. When people say things, they go from a premise to a conclusion. But oftentimes there's nothing to support it. Yes, there are letters to three churches. But the conclusion, therefore, the first three chapters are talking about from the time those letters are written till the end of time. And then the church is raptured up. That's an assumption. So don't be answering, don't fall into the trap of answering an argument that was never made. Just assumed. Okay, and so in chapter 1:19 is a key verse. Why? You remember why? If in confronting this kind of misconception, why is this a key verse? What?
The things that he saw.
Okay, it does do with the things he saw, but there's something else in that verse. After these things. So what do they make that after these things refer to? Where does that begin? In premillennial teaching. Chapter 4. 1 through 3, church age. Till the rapture. Chapter 4, that's after these things. That's the assumption of what that means. We're going to see, we've talked about it in previous classes, that phrase does not denote that. It simply means after this, this succeeded that. It's not talking about, oh, here's one age, and then after these things, another age. So that's an assumption again. But nevertheless, I wanted to mention these things because if you listen to the television, if you have any kind of literature at home or commentaries, or you talk to your friends, this is very likely the kind of things you'll be confronting. And we certainly don't want to fall in the trap of, well, my church doesn't believe that. I hope we never say that. Or my preacher doesn't teach that. We want to be able to go to the text and see what the Bible teaches. All right? Now, in our last class, we were in chapter 6. Chapter 6 is about what? If you wrote at the heading of the chapter, we suggested you make a note there what this chapter is about. What is it about? The first six seals. What's at the top of your lesson on the top line? Yeah, there it is right there, isn't it? The first six seals. How many seals were there? Seven. We know that from chapter 5, correct? So here's the first six. All right. Now, the first four had to do with what? What imagery? What symbolism? Four horses. That's right. And so we were looking at that. And here's how we got to where we are. At least here's my process of reasoning. Number one, the first horse was what color?
White.
How do we reach any conclusions about what that may symbolize? Look in the text here. What are we looking for in other texts for harmony? What white represented throughout Revelation. How many times does it occur? 15 times. The other 14 times is something good. so we would think, unless there's something in the text, as you said, to indicate differently, that this would be something good. Now, that's contrary to the concept you're going to hear, because the white horse, the person on it, in premillennialism represents what? Antichrist. The Antichrist. So this is after the church is raptured. It's gone from the earth, and the Antichrist begins his 7-year reign. But that makes that horse bad. That may be possible, but it's not the way the word white is used in the rest of the book. What is another thing we looked at? The other three horses. So you, if the first horse is good, and we parallel the other three, if they're parallel, then the other three would also be talking about something good for Christians, right? If they're parallel. That's the second thing we looked at. Now, what follows in verse 9, beginning with the fifth seal? You had the first four of the horses and the fifth one. What is the fifth seal about? Martyrs crying out for their blood to be avenged. In other words, for something good to happen for them, which would be bad on their enemies. In other words, avenge their blood. You'll see in verse 10, how long, O Lord, holy and true, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood on those who dwell on the earth? So we know what that section's about. That these men expect God to do something about the way they were treated. Now, the last part of the book, the sixth seal, verse 12 beginning, has a number of symbols. And if these symbols are taken according to their Old Testament roots, how have these symbols been used throughout the Old Testament? What kind of judgment? National judgment. National judgment. So whether you take this book being written in the 60s and referring to the destruction of Jerusalem, or whether you take it in the 90s and referring to Rome, the point is those who brought persecution, verse 9, 10, and 11, against God's people, that nation will suffer God's judgment. All right, so that's how, at least in my thinking, I got there. You may not agree with that, those things, but I just wanted to show you how we got there. We reach a conclusion about something. We need to go back and retrace our steps and be able to see if it's a logical path that we followed instead of merely assumption. Okay, so what I'm suggesting on the white horse is this. That it's a just cause, not a person on the horse. What is it indicated? It's not an individual on the horse. We talked about that also in a previous class.
Concept.
What? I agree it's a concept. What indicates that that's what's meant by one who sat on the horse?
Verse 8.
Right. What about verse 8?
Death.
A concept. That's a good answer, right. So if that's the case, then verse 1, to make that a single person, it doesn't agree, at least in parallel with what we find later. So I'm just suggesting that the white horse is a just cause, and it's doing what? It's conquering. Who is it conquering? The enemies of the people of God. And thus bringing vengeance against their persecutors. And that these four horses are a picture of that. And so if that's what the four horses do, the logical question beginning in verse 9 is what?
When will it happen?
How long? If that's what it's talking about, great. When? And that's what you have. How long, O Lord, will you refrain from judging and avenging our blood upon the earth? So you have these martyrs, verse 9. slain because of the word of God. Think, okay, good. Here's a picture of victory. Conquering our enemies, win. And then you have following that this picture of national judgment. All right. Now, again, I say to you, you may go to a meeting, a gospel meeting. Some of you may end up going to another congregation sometime because of your work changes or whatever, retire and move off to the lake or whatever it may be. And you may hear a preacher say something different from that. Don't be alarmed. Just sit and reason through it. Now, if the white horse is evil, then the question arises, that's unusual for the word white to be used that way. That's the kind of things you look for. Also in verse 4, if this is something about the Christians themselves suffering, it says they'll slay one another. I have a hard time imagining Christians are going to slay one another. But if this is talking about the national judgment, in fact, what happened to Jerusalem, that is what happened. And then that is Jerusalem and Rome. The enemies, the Jerusalem and Rome, worked together, and Rome killed the Jews in the destruction of Jerusalem. And then, so these are some things to think about. Okay, down at the bottom of your lesson, I've got compare Luke 17:20 through 18:8. So let's turn back to Luke 17. In our last class, we finished up looking at Luke 21 at some very similar type language in Matthew 24 as well that pertained to the destruction of Jerusalem, about the sun and the moon and the stars, that kind of thing, that would signify the reign of the Son of Man in heaven. I want to look at Luke 17 now, verse 20 beginning. You see that the Pharisees are asking when the kingdom of God was coming. When they ask about that, they're looking, of course, for when's the armies coming? When's the battle going to be here? Where are the soldiers so we can conquer Rome? Their idea is a materialistic kingdom. And Jesus points out that it is not that kind of a kingdom and not with signs to be observed. He said the kingdom of God is in your midst. Verse 21. And now we get down to verse 22. He said to his disciples, the days will come when you will long to see one of the days of the Son of Man. What does he mean by that? The days of the Son of Man. Well, just hold on to that thought. What does he mean by that? And you will not see it. You will say, look here, look there, look here. Do not go away. Do not run after them. For just as the lightning, when it flashes out of one part of the sky, shines to another part of the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day. His day. Whatever it is, it's going to be something you won't have to run somewhere to see it. It's going to be obvious, in other words. His day. Okay? He said it's going to be like the days of Noah, verse 26. And the days of Lot, verse 28. In the days of Noah, were they ready for the flood? No. In the days of Lot, were they ready for the destruction of those two cities? No. Just like that, people are not going to be ready for the days of the Son of Man that he's talking about. Now, note verse 30. It will be just the same on the day the Son of Man is revealed. We're getting more and more information about this. The days of the Son of Man, verse 22, his day, 24, and he's going to be revealed. Whatever this is, he's going to be revealed. Okay? Now, on that day, whoever's in the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. Whoever's in the field must not turn back. If this is talking about something yet to happen, what's strange about that? Yeah, we don't live on housetops anymore. Most of us don't go out in the field too much, do we? He's talking about their day and their society. And so they did have housetops they went up on. They were out in the fields working. They were agricultural. Verse 34, I tell you, on that night there'll be two in one bed, one will be taken, the other left. There'll be two women grinding at the same place. How many of you ground meal? You like to go H-E-B and buy it already ground, don't you? I'll be. But they actually grind. They had means by which they could grind their meal, right? Their grain. So, two men will be in the field, one taken, one left. And in verse 37, answering, they said to him, "Where, Lord? Where is this going to happen?" He said to them, "Where the body is, there will the vultures be gathered." What's that? A vulture, a bird that feeds on dead bodies. That's the picture. Something's dead, and the vultures are coming to consume it. Hold your finger here for just a moment. Go to Matthew chapter 24. Well, start in 23. This is a severe condemnation of the leaders of the Jews, the Pharisees and scribes, chapter 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, over and over through the chapter. And then he talked about verse 32, fill up the measure of your fathers. This is what your fathers did, and you're doing the same thing, verse 32. And so verse 35, upon you will fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah. And so he said, verse 36, all these things will come upon who? This generation. If the word generation means people living on the earth at the same time, this would talk about a period of time somewhere around 40 years. Now he said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. This is addressed to Jerusalem. And he said, verse 38, your house is being left to you desolate. Just forget the chapter division. He went out of the temple, chapter 24:1, and Jesus said, see this temple? We had time with not one stone left upon the other. And the disciples then asked the question, verse 3, tell us, when will these things happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Immediately people make that the second coming. They didn't even know he's leaving to come back. They didn't know he's going to die and be raised. But nevertheless, and of the end of the age. Now, get down to verse 28. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. It's very similar symbol as Luke 21, which we read earlier, some of these same symbols, and here in Luke 17 and verse 37. And also about the being on the housetop and being in the field and those kind of same type things spoken of in Matthew 24. Now, in Matthew 24, we have a time parameter. What is it? Verse 34. These things will happen before this generation is passed. I suggest to you that's what he's talking about in Luke 17, the destruction of Jerusalem. Now, we talked about in our last class, when Jesus got through with his mission. Well, fact, who ended his mission? Who ended it? The Jews. They arrested him and crucified him unjustly. And then he went back to heaven. The apostles take off on their mission. Who threw him in jail? Jews. Who killed James? Herod, ruler of the Jews. Who stoned Stephen? Jews. And just all the way through the book of Acts. Okay, now look at chapter 18 of Luke. He was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. Jesus is preaching all of this about AD 30 to 33, somewhere in there. So he talks about this judgment that's going to come. It'll be a day of the Son of Man. That is, a day in which his rule and dominion is revealed. And when we compare the similar passage in Matthew 24, you see that very concept. But you get to Luke 18. And he said, this parable, this Don't give up. Don't lose heart. Don't get discouraged. So here's this woman. She's being mistreated, and she pleads to the judge. And look what she says. Verse 3, give me legal protection for my opponent. Down in verse 7, will not God bring about justice for his elect who cry to him day and night? And will he delay long over them? And keep your finger at Luke 18, because we're going to go back and forth. Go to Revelation 16. Verse 5. I heard the angel of the water say, righteous are you who are and who were the Holy One, because you judged these things. For they poured out the blood of saints and prophets. What were the martyrs crying about in our chapter we're studying? Their blood being avenged. He says here, you judged them. And what did they say at the end of verse 6? They're worthy. They deserve it. That doesn't sound like the attitude you often hear today, does it, that Christians are supposed to have. There is a righteous sense of expecting judgment against enemies. In verse 7, yes, O Lord, the Almighty, true and righteous are your judgments. Go to chapter 19 and verse 2. Because his judgments are true and righteous, for he has judged the great harlot who is corrupting the earth with her immorality, and he has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her. When he avenges their blood, that's a judgment of justice. They got what they deserve. That's what this woman is crying for. And Jesus says, will not God bring about justice for his elect who cry to him day and night? We read in chapter 5 about the bowls of incense, which are what? The prayers of the saints. You reckon they prayed about this? Maybe they prayed the same thing this woman was praying for. We know what they prayed in chapter 6. Okay, now, in Luke 18, he said, verse 7, will he delay long over them? Now, look at, you don't have to look at it. Revelation 1:1 and 1:3. Our verse that said, whatever I'm talking about is going to be near soon, isn't it? And then look at chapter 10, Revelation 10, and verse 6 and 7. Swore by him who lived forever and ever, who created heaven and the things in it, earth and the things in it, and the sea and the things in it, that there will be what? Delay no longer. That's almost the same thing as you read in Luke 18, isn't it? There will be delay no longer. How long will you delay? There'll be delay no longer. All right, and then in Luke 18:8, it says, I tell you when he comes to bring justice for them quickly, I tell you that he will bring about justice for them, what? Quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes what? To bring justice against the adversaries of God's people. All right. Now, look at Revelation 1:7. He is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. So that's talking about Christ, isn't it? But verse 8, very possibly about the Father. What is the last phrase about the Father? He is to come, or is coming. If you note your marginal note. In chapter 4, you see the same thing. In verse 8, who was and is to come, or is coming. Now look in chapter 3 and verse 11. I am coming quickly. 2,000 years later? Or is it judgment upon their enemies? And then we read 22 a while ago, those verses. I'm coming quickly. Over here, it says to this woman, about this woman, will not God not delay long? Will he not bring justice for them quickly when the Son of Man comes to bring this justice? And then the last question in verse 8 is, will he find faith on the earth? In Revelation 2:10, many of you can quote it. What did he tell the church in Smyrna? Be faithful unto death. Faithful meaning what? Full of faith. Let faith govern you and sustain you. Persecutions come. Trials come. Where's Jesus? Where's God? Jesus said, when he comes, will he find faith on the earth? Will he find people who persevere in faith? In chapter 3 and verse 9, he talks about the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not. He said, I'm going to show them that I love you. But verse 11, he says, hold fast what you have, that no one will take your crown. So this picture that we have in chapter 6 of Revelation fits, kind of corresponds to Luke 17 and 18. And when you read Luke 18, you make application, connect it with 17. And so, yes, suffering Christians in these seven churches. Yes, some of your loved ones have died for their faith, but I assure you, God knows it. And yes, God is going to do something about it. Yes, those who did that will be punished. He will bring justice. And it's only right to believe that. Somebody says, you got to just forgive people to get rid of that burden. No, I do not have just got to forgive people if they're impenitent. How are you going to deal with that? God will take care of it. That's how I deal with it. I forgive people who are penitent. But Romans 12 says, leave the vengeance to God. That's not my department. But I know God will vindicate his people. That's what I know. And so I'll leave that in his court. Okay, any other comments on chapter 6 before we move to chapter 7? Yes, sir. Good point. A little while longer. Just a little while longer. Another couple thousand years. Yes, sir, Trey.
For the people who make the argument that this is about the destruction of Rome, the fall of Rome would have been at least 300, some could argue 400, or even several hundred years after this letter would have been written. So even that seems like it's a little while longer than just a little while.
Yes, that's a good question I think Trey brought up. If you believe it's Rome, you know, Rome didn't fall for another 300 or 400 years. Maybe that's it. I don't know. And I don't make a big issue about the date of the letter. But I think Trey has brought up a really good question, at least, when you're trying to put things on each two. You know, you could put a line down the middle of a page. Is it talking about destructing Jerusalem or Rome? And you start putting things in each column that favor one or the other. And this is a good question, I think, that Trey has raised. If it's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, was it a little while longer referred to? 70 AD. And from the time this letter is written, when?
10 years.
Yeah, at the most 10 years, maybe less. That's right. Okay, chapter 7, the 144,000. I guess maybe what we ought to start off doing is just read the first 8 verses. 144,000 on the earth are sealed. You see that on your... you have an outline with this. And up at the top you have chapter 7, the first interlude. So we had the first 6 seals, but now we have an interlude before we get to the 7th seal. You got this 144,000 in the first part of this chapter and the great multitude in the last part of this chapter. Again, this is a... favorite feel for different religious groups and views that they talk about. We'll mention those briefly as we go through, but trying to understand what we can, at least about the chapter. What we want to do as we go through the book, even though we're going to leave a lot of, as Joe Fitch used to call it, stumps in your field, what we want to do is put some anchors in the ground, some things we can establish. That's what we're trying to do. Okay, so after this, by the way, what did the premillennialists make after this refer to in 4:1? After these things, same phrase.
Be a new era or age.
New era, new age. Is that what it means here? This is all in the period of the tribulation, isn't it? According to them. Why didn't it mean that here? Why is this not a new age? See? Huh? That's exactly the right answer. That's right. It's not something 2,000 years later from chapter 6. The Antichrist, chapter 6:1, if they're right. Of course, that's the beginning of the 7 years of tribulation. So, after this, just in other words, succeeding that is all he means by that. I saw. So he's watching this thing. Here's the next thing that came on the screen. Here's the next thing that came on the stage, as it were, if you're watching a play. I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth, so that no wind could blow on the earth, on the sea, or in any tree. Now, what's he talking about? Things to happen where? On the earth. Three times in that first verse. I want you to note that. Because when you get to verse 9, where are things taking place? Before the throne. Chapter 4, it may have seemed like a strange marking back there when I said a geographical marking, throne. You can see maybe here the value, earth versus throne. And we'll talk about that some more as we go through the chapter. I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. So this becomes an idea here in these first few verses, this idea of a seal. The seal of the living God. And he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees. So if you're watching this, you see I don't know how they would do it in a play, but you see the earth, the trees, where people live here on this earth. And he said, don't harm that until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. And then he has 12 tribes mentioned. It's a different numbering of the tribe, listing of the tribe, because Ephraim and Dan are not mentioned. Joseph is mentioned as well as Manasseh, when actually in the Old Testament, Joseph was divided into Manasseh and Ephraim, which is another indication this is not physical Jews. There are several indications. And yet, if you're reading premillennial literature, that's what it is, physical Jews. But nevertheless, you have this listing, and in each tribe, there's an exact number, 12,000 in each one. That becomes significant, the exact number. And so let's stop there for just a moment. And the verse 9 deals with what he calls the great multitude before the throne. Okay. What is the idea of a seal? Now, I know you think about the seal on the tomb, can't get in, but seals were used to mark identity. What does a rancher do with his cows? Brands them. These are mine. These belong to me. And if you look, I had on your lesson Ezekiel. I don't know if you took the time there to read that, but let's go back to Ezekiel for just a moment. Sir? It is indeed. And so In Ezekiel, when Ezekiel is prophesying, there's already been two deportations, 605, 598, and 7. And Ezekiel starts prophesying. He's taken the second one, and he starts prophesying about the third one that's going to happen in 586 and 7. But he's a captive over in Babylon where they were taken. And so it's interesting, in 8:1, in the sixth year of the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me. This thing reeks of hypocrisy. The elders are sitting before him. In another chapter in the book, they're asking him questions. I don't know if that's what they're doing here. But here are the elders of Judah, as if they're interested in what this young prophet, aged about 31 or 32, has to say. Chapter 14 says they've got idolatry in their heart. Sometimes the fellows who you think are the most godly are the most corrupt in heart. But nevertheless, chapter 8 is an interesting, interesting chapter, because what happens, God takes Ezekiel from where he's a captive and says, let me show you some things, and he takes him back to Jerusalem, to the temple area. He said, let me show you what's going on over there. Let me show you why I'm going to bring judgment. We don't have time to read chapter 8, but it is an interesting chapter along that line. Now you get to chapter 9. So here's the city. Ezekiel's been carried back over there to look at the city. And I see Doug sitting there ready to buzz me out. So real quick here. He's looking at the city. If you haven't read chapter 9, read at least chapter 9. There's all this wickedness going on in Jerusalem. A lot of it they're trying to hide. So you've got executioners, verse 1, with a destroying weapon. They're going to go through the city destroying people. And so then you get down to verse 4. The Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations. Go through there and mark the ones who are not happy with what's going on, who don't participate in what's going on. And then you get down to verse 6. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women. But now note verse 6. Do not touch any man on whom is the mark. In other words, they're going to be protected from what's fixing to happen. They belong to God. These are mine. Read that imagery. Go back and read this section in chapter 7. We'll pick up in chapter 7. Hopefully we can get through this chapter as well in our study on Wednesday night. Thank you.